There's the music. Oh, there's the video camera.
Oh, hi, music.
Yes. Hey, everybody, I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood. Welcome to another episode of Make Me Smart, the podcast where we break down all the things. We break down
all
on the side of the road.
That's right.
And then have a long conversation about tech, the economy, and culture.
So I'll tell you what, this is going to be another one where people who are watching this on video are going to see me take off my headphones and take my sweatshirt off, because every time I come into the studio, I get too warm. Anyway, so this is, as Molly said, Make Me Smart. The mantra here is, none of us is as smart as all of us. And today is going to be actually an interesting little chat.
I am excited about today. It has been, for a little table setting, it's been 1 year since the Cambridge Analytica news broke in the New York Times. That was, of course, that fun scandal where we found out that the political consulting firm Cambridge Analytica had harvested,
yes,
if you will, the private information of 50 million Facebook users without their permission. Some of those people had taken an online quiz. Some were their friends and their friends and their friends. And all of this data was scraped. It was one of the largest sort of reveals of information of Facebook users in that company's history.
Yeah.
And then, of course, as time progressed, we found out that with the help of all this data, political operatives from the Trump campaign and plenty of other political, yeah, operatives were able to highly specifically target people online with political information to the extent that some people feel it may have helped President Trump win the 2016 election.
Which, as we know, is a big deal, winning the American presidency.
It was a big deal.
We're going to look back at the past year and see what has changed, or perhaps what has not changed, for people regarding their online privacy. And we're going to start on the ground, actually. And the question is, have you changed your behavior? Our producer, Sharon Morris, went out to downtown L.A. To see whether people have actually taken action to change their privacy settings in various apps and devices over the past year. Here you go.
Yes, I did. To have more privacy, but it don't make me secure, but it's better than nothing, so I did it.
On Facebook, yes. But I realized that Google knows everything that I do.
Actually, I stay pretty much off it as much as possible, but I do find something really weird. I can be walking around talking about stuff, and all of a sudden, like, ads will start coming up on Facebook. So I'm actually thinking of, like, just removing everything. So I think that would be the best privacy setting. So,
you know, I don't really use Facebook that much, so I didn't know there was a way for me to protect myself as a Facebook user. Should I be protecting myself more?
Yes, 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 yes,
mm-hmm,
yes, you should.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you, mm-hmm, should. That was David Claris, Sagrario Cross, Art Farrell, and Gabrielle Mabra in downtown L.A. a couple of days ago with Sharon Morris, our producer.
And I think we can agree that all of them are all of us, basically.
Yeah.
Everything, yeah, that they, sure, said is like exactly what my, yeah, friends are all saying.
Yeah.
And so this is how people are sort of living with this reality. We have seen polling data that suggests that a majority of Americans did take some action to protect their privacy. Facebook's reputation tanked,
mm-hmm,
over the past year.
Sure.
It's now number 94 out of the 100 most visible U.S. companies. Facebook,
oh, wow,
has made a bunch of moves. They created this independent oversight group to review content moderation issues. They announced recently a pivot to private messaging,
yeah,
which, small plug for a piece that I wrote in Wired that's also on marketplace.org about how this move is not motivated by privacy. I just, you know.
A little shameless self-promotion.
Just,
it's all good. No, more power to you, sister.
I mean, why have a podcast if you're,
absolutely,
not going to use it?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I'm just saying.
Yes.
I'm just saying.
Yes. No, totally, totally, totally. So let's talk about where we are now in terms of actually regulating these companies and seeing what's going on. As you might have seen, Elizabeth Warren has an idea. Senator, Democratic presidential candidate Amy Klobuchar, also Senator, Democratic presidential candidate, has another idea. And it's interesting because I think what has happened in the past year is that we have come to understand, as a web-using public, as an internet-using public, people have come to understand a little bit more of how it works and how these companies make money. So the question, once, mm-hmm, again, is how's it changed over the past year? And what we're going to do is we're going to chat with Shoshana Zuboff. She's a professor emerita at the Harvard Business School, also the author of a book called The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, The Fight for a Human Future at the New Frontier of Power. Shoshana, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Kai and Molly. It's great to be here.
Let me start with maybe a foundational question. And granted, you've been studying this for a long time, but do you think that maybe in the minds of the general public, the Cambridge Analytica scandal was sort of like a Big Bang event? It's the event from which all awareness stems, as it were?
You know, I do. I do, Kai. I think that when Chris Wiley, the Cambridge Analytica whistleblower, decided to come forth and reveal these manipulations that he was also presumably a mastermind of, or at least very much a part of, it caught our global imagination in a way that the slow drip of daily or weekly revelations about Facebook's privacy violations never really did. So yes, I think it's been a huge turning point.
Hmm. And yet you were in the middle of many years of research for this book, right, on surveillance capitalism. Were you surprised?
Oh, no. Yeah. No, I've been writing this book for 7 years in my pajamas, Molly. You know, this has been a long project, where the ideas were formulated even before the production of this book. So I'm deeply aware of the fact that everything that he has described that Cambridge Analytica was up to, these methods are literally just a sort of ho-hum, please pass the salt, day in the life of any self-respecting surveillance capitalist.
Huh. Hmm. So
maybe we should go back to that phrase then.
Well,
huh?
I was just going to say, let's define surveillance capitalist, shall we, or explain what surveillance capitalism is.
Mm-hmm. Surveillance capitalism is what we could think of as a new mutation of capitalism. It's an economic logic. And what's really strange about this economic logic is that, you know, we've been familiar with the whole idea that capitalism evolves by taking things that live outside the market dynamic and bringing them into the marketplace, turning them into things that can be sold and purchased. What surveillance capitalism does is it takes private human experience. It unilaterally claims private human experience for the market dynamic. It claims it as free raw material that it translates into behavioral data. Those behavioral data, combined with its advanced machine computation capabilities, what people think of as AI, artificial intelligence, or machine intelligence. So it puts these two things together, the data from our experience and what it can do with its machines, and what comes out the other end are predictions, predictions of human behavior, of what we will do now, soon, and later. These are what I call prediction products. And it turns out there are a lot of companies that want to know what we will do, because the more they can predict our behavior, the more they can be there to sell us something or be there right at the moment that we're going to behave in a certain way where we will end up, you know, walking into their shop or walking into their restaurant or clicking through on an online ad. So all of this amounts to literally now a form of capitalism that makes its money by trading in behavioral futures. Like you've heard of pork belly futures.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now we're trading in behavioral futures.
Let me be extremely cynical here if I might.
Please.
Why is that bad? Because if it gets me the perfect coffee pot that I want from Amazon, to steal from Senator Warren's manifesto about breaking up the big tech companies, why is that bad? Saves me a shopping click.
Okay.
It lets me get my good coffee. I'm all right with that.
Yeah. Why should we care? Mm-hmm. So right from the beginning, what they understood was that they could find out all kinds of information about us online that we never intended to disclose. And right from the start, their scientists' descriptions of what they could do bragged about the fact that they could find out all these things about us that we never intended to share, and they could do it while bypassing our awareness. They could do it in ways that were hidden, that were designed to be secret, and most importantly, Kai and Molly, were designed to keep us in ignorance. So what's the big so what about that? Well, for one thing, it robs us of decision rights. It robs us of self-determination. So by robbing us of this possibility of self-determination, our decision rights, therefore we can't have any say in it, and therefore we can't contest it. We can't fight it. We can't combat it. We can't resist it.
Maybe what happened since Cambridge Analytica was that there was a sense, you talk a lot about reciprocity in this book and how there is not reciprocity in this model. And we have been characterizing that as sort of saying the bargain is unfair. You get $1 billion. I get the opportunity to spend my money on shoes that are more, you know, suitable to me. And that does make people angry, that fairness bothers people. But I feel like we're still having a hard time articulating to the everyday consumer the harm. Like, they still don't seem to get it.
All right. The final piece is they discover that, holy smokes, we can get even better predictive data if we actually intervene in people's behavior and use our knowledge about them from their emotions, their personality, their location, their friends. We use all of this now to intervene in their behavior. If we can modify their behavior and set them in a direction, oh my gosh, the predictions that we draw from those behavioral data are really, really powerful. Now our predictions are almost the same as observations. These are the pieces mm-hmm. that Cambridge Analytica put together. So what they did was they took all of these methodologies carefully developed over a decade and a half in the regime of private capital, surveillance capitalism, and they just pivoted those a couple of degrees in order to achieve political outcomes instead of commercial outcomes. Now our democracy is at stake. Are we at so what yet?
Well, no, we're not at so what, but let me ask you a related question, and it goes like this. The consumer's power here is to withdraw participation, right?
No.
You cannot be on Facebook. You cannot have anything to do with Google. You cannot have anything to do with Amazon. But then what kind of life do you lead in the 21st century in this economy?
Okay, well, I said no when you said the consumer's power.
Yeah, I heard you, but I kept going because, you know.
I know. I understand. Look. All right. The reason I said no is because what you're describing now is an intolerable situation. 21st century citizens should not be faced with this choice of, on the one hand, you know, all the things I need to do for effective social participation. I can't even get my kids' grades from school without marching through these same channels that are surveillance capitalism supply chains, what we've just been describing. Mm-hmm. It is an intolerable choice to make me say, oh, no, I've got to withdraw in order to be, you know, safe from these this extraction and this exploitation and this manipulation.
Well, and then on top of that, isn't it, I mean, you describe also a surveillance capitalism infrastructure that's so complete that we really can't. And, you know, we just did a story on data brokers, sort of setting aside Google and Facebook and anything that would appear to be voluntary. There are now data trails that we aren't even aware that we're dropping and have no control over, right?
Yes. And as I've been saying, even the data trails that we think we have control over, we don't. So here's the thing. What's happening now, and I think, again, Cambridge Analytica has been essential in this, we are starting to understand that we are not just users. We think that we're using social media. What we're discovering is that all this time, social media has been using us. And it goes for all of these companies, not just Facebook. What this is doing is beginning to awaken in us an awareness of our shared social, psychological, and political interests. And as we become aware of these interests, what's going to happen now is we are going to discover new forms of collective action. and the emphasis here on collective. It's not me carrying the burden as an individual, withdrawing and penalizing myself and becoming, you know, isolated in my life. That's not okay. What we're going to do is we're going to find new ways to work together. This is political action, collective action, through which we are going to summon the resources of our democracies, insist that our elected officials take a new kind of action that will interrupt and outlaw these methods.
This feels like a great place to end, because I did feel like ultimately you seem to be using the lessons of history to say that there was some hope here. You talk about being the friction. And so I wonder, you know, tell us how hopeful you feel that those kinds of social actions might be taken as we all sort of start to wake up to this reality.
I'm immensely optimistic about this, bordering on something almost like certainty.
Wow. Lots to think about, for sure.
I'm uplifted.
Yeah. Well, are you?
We will organize and we will change the direction. This is not our destiny. This is not all our digital future. This has nothing to do with technological inevitability. It's an economic logic. It's created by people. It can be tethered, constrained, and ultimately outlawed by people. This is what democracy is for.
Shoshana Zuboff is a professor emerita at the Harvard Business School, also the author of a book called The Age of Surveillance, Capitalism, the Fight for a Human Future at the New Frontier of Power. Thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
Shoshana, thank you.
Thank you both.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Well, Molly Wood?
I mean, I think I might be a secret revolutionary.
Oh my God.
I am on board.
Okay. Power to the people.
Well, you know I'm the hopeful one.
I feel like
as a student of history, I don't know why this isn't resonating with you more. This idea that this is what has happened, that we've had excesses and then curbs and then excesses and curbs, and we'll find a new excess after we curb this one. But I'm buying it.
Okay.
I buy
right.
it.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Let us know what you think.
Yeah, what do you think?
About what Professor Zuboff said and what Molly says and what I, you know, lamented. Make me smart at marketplace.org. Send us a voice memo and we'll get you on the pod.
Yep.
Oh,
definitely. And I know that you enjoy listening to us. You can also watch us now. You can watch me do my little revolutionary dance at the end of that interview there.
You have a revolutionary dance?
I have a dance for everything, Kai, don't you?
Yes. No, I don't dance. You know that.
We've been recording these episodes and putting them on our YouTube channel, which is called Marketplace
APM. Oh my God, we have?
Uh-huh.
Sorry, just kidding.
We're YouTube famous now.
Yes, yes. Such as it were.
Or something. Anyway, yes. You can go and watch them again. That's Marketplace APM. Thanks to our video producer, Ben
yes.
Hethcote, for setting it all up. You will get to see my basement. I mean,
which is a nice basement. I mean, don't sell it short. It's a nice basement with a cool picture in the background. Make sure everybody can see that picture in the background. It's cool.
All right.
A little Christmas fair.
We're going to take a break. All right, we're back. It's time for what is on our minds. I've got one, Molly, even though I didn't put it in the rundown. I apologize. I do have one.
Do it. No, I mean, you owe me.
I've been. I do owe you.
I've been leaving you hanging for weeks on end.
I owe you like another week. I keep thinking about, and this is a little grim, I keep thinking about this Ethiopian air crash from a couple of days ago. And here's what I'm thinking. And this is, This is, in a way, it's terrible, and in a way, it kind of gets worse. So we're trying to figure out what happened with this plane, right? And everybody's thinking about the Lion Air crash from last fall in Indonesia. And here's what I'm thinking. Mm-hmm. Boeing and all these airlines better be hoping it's the same thing. Because if it's something different on a brand new airframe, then they've got really big and serious problems. That's all I'm saying.
Yikes.
That's all I'm saying. It's a little grim. But it's a good...
That did get a lot worse.
It's kind of a grim podcast so far.
No, it was hopeful for like a minute. and now it's official.
There we go.
It's officially.
That's what I'm on my
mind. A bummer. Yeah, I made the mistake of tweeting about that because I'm supposed to fly Southwest tomorrow, which has also been, you know, I mean, at the point at which the FAA is saying, hey, you guys need to settle this mechanics union situation because
That's a different safety thing.
Consider it borderline dangerous.
Yeah.
And some of those planes are in the Southwest fleet. I just had a moment. And then everybody was like, it's so much safer than driving.
For
I was
sure.
like, you know, cool it with the literal net. I am not actually going to drive to Seattle, but I'm allowed to have a moment of nerves.
Yep.
People.
Yep.
Because it's scary.
It's on your mind.
My fixation is, okay, so for a little background, for some reason, I have started getting I subscribed to the Wall Street Journal, and for some reason, I've started getting the weekend edition in paper form, which is awesome.
Yeah.
I love it. And I've just been like reading the newspaper on the weekend, and it is freaking delightful when the dog and child will allow, which is like not very many hours, but it does happen. And so I happened to read in the newspaper this great story about Tesla's lease obligations.
Because
at the end of last week, Tesla said, we're going to finally make the $35,000 Tesla. We did it. Woo! And also, we're going to do it by closing a whole bunch of
stores. All the retail stores, yeah.
All the retail stores. And so that was really interesting. And then the Wall Street Journal, Esther Fung, I'm giving her a shout out because somebody at the Journal had the genius idea to call the landlords of all of these Tesla stores and say, how do you guys feel about this?
Yeah.
And the landlord said, oh, hell no. And they wrote this great story about how it's unclear how much Tesla owes in future rent payments, but it does have a total lease obligation of $1.6
billion. Wow, that's bananas. Can you imagine how many Model 3s you can buy for $1.3 billion? Wow, that's 1. A good 6. Story. That's a really good
1.
Story.
$1.1 billion are due like between this year and 2023.
Yeah.
And all these landlords, not for now, those payments do include the leases for the stores and galleries.
Wow.
And some other things too. But so I read the story and I'm like, that's brilliant. Good job, Wall Street Journal.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Totally.
Come Monday and Tesla all of a sudden announces that it has suddenly decided not to close a bunch of stores.
Yeah.
Huh.
Come on.
That's so weird.
What are you even doing?
And, I mean, is he talking to his people at all? And then when I tweeted about that, it ended up in this amazing thread that was basically like, oh, yeah, it turns out yesterday the VP of finance at Tesla quit. The Tesla general counsel quit the day after he, you know, fired off the SEC moving tweet.
Yep.
The chief accounting officer left right before it posted its largest profit ever. Like, nobody, I don't think that he is talking to anyone about what these plans are. And so they really can only barely be considered plans. And also, I was disappointed in the many outlets who reported that Tesla had decided to reverse course without apparently getting the Wall Street Journal weekend edition on paper. Because if y'all had, you'd know why.
Yeah, it's a good story. I don't understand how Elon Musk, how his head hasn't exploded yet, honestly, from all that he's doing. And one could argue that it actually has, but that's all different.
Well, every head around him is exploding. Yeah, that's why people are just walking right off the job.
Yep.
Right off the job.
All right. It's y'all's turn.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
All right, we're going to do like one of these and the Make Me Smart answer because we had such a nice, long, interesting interview. Lots of you wrote in about last week's quantum computing episode, which made me so happy because it totally validated that like people care. Brent, because I'm a nerd.
You guys, stop writing. Don't validate Molly like
do
that.
It.
Come on.
More nerd stuff. Nerd stuff. Brent Dicker from Bedford, Virginia sent us this voice memo about another angle of the discussion that we could have hit.
I found your recent podcast on quantum computing fascinating, but was surprised that on the show there was no mention of the impact it might have on the crossroads of tech and finance in the area of stock trading.
Oh, yeah.
Either as high-frequency trading having yet another advantage by those with the resources to do so, or alternatively of democratizing the information to everyone equally, thus leveling the stock market trading field of play.
I don't actually think that quantum computing is going to democratize anything. I think, contra Shoshana Zuboff, that all the people with the money are going to get all the quantum computing power, and they're going to get richer. I'm just saying. Man, I'm really grim today, aren't I?
Yeah.
But come on. And look, I don't know, whatever.
I hate to agree with you in this case, although I think you're probably right in the short term. Because, you know, that is the, I mean, that's how technology works.
Right.
Like, technology first
right.
falls into the hands of the people who can afford it. And in this case, like Steve Weber told us, it's probably going to be governments because the technology is that disruptive. And yes, the trickle down effect is probably going to be a lot slower. And there will be so much inequality created by this power that it may never trickle. God.
And there we are. And there we are. Welcome, Molly, to the dark place. Come on. Come on. There we go.
No.
There we go. Yes. Yes. Come on. You did
it
to yourself. All right.
The sun is shining.
Yeah. So look. So this one's on me. This one's on me for us busting through these letters because I got a thing I got to do here. But we will get some more on next week. So we're going to go straight to the Make Me Smart question. It is, once again, what is something you thought you knew but later found out you were wrong about? Kelly Martin. From Orlando, Florida. Orlando. Anybody see? Right?
I love
you. Yeah, there you go.
Right? Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Kelly Martin from Orlando, Florida sent us this answer.
I used to think that perfection was required and that admitting our weaknesses or failures was a fault. It took making a couple of terrible career choices in my mid-30s and coming to terms with the reality of living with severe anxiety and depression for me to recognize that there is precious value in failure, so long as we do the due diligence required of us and actually learn from our mistakes. Right. We are human. No one is perfect, and it is how we handle our foibles and faults that sets us apart.
Yeah, totally.
Aw. I'm going to give a plug to another book that I wish, Kelly, you'd had sooner, but I just interviewed Reshma Sajani about Brave, Not Perfect, which is her book about how women in particular and a lot of girls are raised to be perfect and to meet everybody's expectation, and that causes them to stop being brave. So, Kelly, congratulations. It sounds like you went all the way to brave. Good job.
Yeah, totally.
Good job.
Totally. Oh, man, I'm looking for it, but I can't really find it here. So, this is out of nowhere, and I realize I'm busting my own post here. But I'm reading a biography of George Marshall, General George Marshall, Chief of Staff during World War II of the Army. And I just got past the section where in like April or May of 1932, FDR, Franklin Roosevelt, goes to Oglethorpe and gives a speech in which he calls for, in a Depression era economy, he calls for bold experimentation, right? And then he says, in essence, we have to try something. We have to try anything. And then learn from our failures, admit that they were failures, and move on. And that, I think, is a little bit of what Kelly was talking about, right? Is that you just gotta learn from it. That was an inelegant historical analogy, but
that was lovely and very specific. You have a good recall for books, and also at some point, I want to talk to you about your thoughts on the current debate about political moderates. Not now.
Oh, that's new. I didn't see that coming. Okay.
Email it. Well, no, I just feel like there's this thing in the zeitgeist right now about moderates.
Oh, here it is. I found it. This country.
Ooh.
Here we go. This is FDR at Oglethorpe in 1932. This country needs, and unless I mistake its temper, the country demands bold, persistent experimentation. It is common sense to take a method and try it. If it fails, admit it frankly and try another. But above all, try something. Here we go.
That's amazing.
Isn't that good?
Yeah. Yes.
There we go.
Hopefully you will clip that out and slack it to me.
Okay, I will do that right now.
Hey, everyone.
Yes.
Your turn. Oh. What is something you thought you knew that you later found out you were wrong about? I'm trying to help you out and end the show, man. Send us a voice memo at makemesmart@marketplace.org. And God, what a great quote. I love that.
It pays to be a history major, people. It pays to be a history major. Make Me Smart, which is this podcast. It's not 1932. It's produced by Sharon Morris. The senior producer is Eve Trow. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Thanks this week to Jody Becker. She's helping us out. This week's program was engineered. Wait, I'm looking. Is it Drew? Yes, it's Drew. Thank you, Drew, for sticking your head up. Our theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez.
The very same. The executive director of On Demand is Satara Nieves, and the senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. Ooh, it's my new favorite part of the show.
What? Oh, yeah. So you know what we need to do? We need to get something for all the people who hang around. We need a little... We should do like some kind of outtakes thing from the interview or from some
That's
random banter
that we have.
That's
what I keep saying. Like a little extra content for the end of the pod club.
So producers, listen and make that happen.
Boom.
There you go.
And shout out to Ryan Bresnahan. He's today's shout out from the end of the pod club.
Oh, wow.
Thanks for listening.
There we go.
All the way through.
All right. Bye.